Today is Thursday, 20th November 2025, and before I proceed with this program, let me again remind you that once you've watched or listened to this program, if you liked what you've heard, please remember to tick the like button to indicate that fact. Now, with that, let's move forward with the program itself, because the last 24 hours have been remarkable and extraordinarily dramatic, and they've basically thrown the whole situation in relation to Ukraine back in flux. Now, what has happened is that over the course of the last couple of hours, since I made my program yesterday, more information has been dribbling out, or pouring out perhaps would be more accurate, about the peace proposal supposedly being worked out by Steve Witkoff and Kirill Dmitriev. Now, there is apparently there was a post on X by Steve Witkoff indicating that the United States, that the US government had not intended to disclose the fact that the discussions between Witkoff and Dmitriev had been underway, and that the Americans and the Russians were working on this plan, but that the plan was leaked by someone. And supposedly, now I want to stress, I did not see this post on X myself, but that supposedly the details of this plan were then leaked by Kay. Kay presumably is General Kellogg, Keith Kellogg. And, well, a couple of hours yesterday, after the first leaks about this plan appeared, an announcement, or at least an information, started to circulate in Washington. And this has been apparently confirmed that General Kellogg, deeply angered and frustrated by the way events have been proceeding, has apparently confirmed that at the expiry of his one-year term as President Trump's peace negotiator, Ukraine peace negotiator, that at the end of it, he intends to retire. In other words, that Kellogg intends to quit his post at some time in January. Now, that suggests that what has happened is that Kellogg, who clearly doesn't agree with the proposal that we now see being fleshed out between Witkoff and Dmitriev, that Kellogg leaked the details of this proposal, perhaps to Axios and The Economist and the Financial Times, and perhaps he was then called to account about the fact, and at that point he may have taken the decision to resign, or perhaps he was asked to make it clear that he would not be seeking an extension of his term. This is to some extent a reconstruction of events, but it would make a great deal of sense if it were true, and it would explain a lot of the confusion that we saw yesterday. So what do we actually know? The first thing that we do know is that some kind of document is being worked on by Witkoff and Dmitriev, that the Russians and the Americans are working on some kind of document together. This document apparently also has input from various other people. On the US side, we're told that the Vice President, J.D. Vance, and the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, are also involved in working on this document. there's less word about who is involved on the Russian side, apart from Dmitriev, just saying. But apparently there is joint work being done to iron out and crystallize this document. The work is not complete. There are still discussions, apparently, about some of the exact terms and some of the contradictory information we have been getting over the last 24 hours about what this document contains, perhaps reflects the fact that there is still a lack of full consensus or agreement about every single point. And perhaps the document as it exists at the moment contains, as these kind of documents often do, alternative positions suggested by each side, which have not yet received full agreement. And I am going to say something further, which is that I believe that this document is essentially the follow-up to the discussions that took place between Witkoff and Putin in August, and the agreement that the two presidents, Trump and Putin, verbally reached with each other at the summit meeting in Alaska. Ever since that summit meeting, as we now know, we know because the Russians themselves have told us, there have been expectations from the Russians that the United States would come back with its considered and detailed response to the proposals and tentative agreements reached in Alaska. The Russians have been increasingly frustrated and impatient about the length of time that the Americans have been taking with this process. They have been dismayed by the fact that at one point the President of the United States, Donald Trump, was actually talking about supplying, or rather deploying, Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. And the Russians made it very clear that they were very unhappy with that and that they did not want that to happen. All of this then eventually, as Lavrov explained to Corriere della Sera, resulted in an outreach by Donald Trump to Putin. Trump asked for a further telephone call with Putin, this on the eve of a meeting in Washington between Trump and Zelensky. Trump seems to have assured Putin over the course of that call that during the meeting with Zelensky, he would get Zelensky's agreement to the draft proposals that had been reached, or rather the tentative proposals that had been reached by the Americans and the Russians in Alaska, in Anchorage. As we know from the media, the conversation between Trump and Zelensky went badly wrong. Zelensky pushed back strongly. There were apparently raised voices. Trump at one point threw the maps that Zelensky was trying to show him to one side. But in the end, it was Trump, not Zelensky, who caved. And it was Trump who told Zelensky that he agreed with the proposal that Zelensky was pushing and which Kellogg had originally made, that there should be a freeze of the conflict on the existing conflict lines. A proposal which, of course, the Russians have utterly rejected. And then we got an extraordinary and very difficult period, lasting now a few weeks, over the course of which the United States again tilted strongly back towards Ukraine. There was sanctions imposed on Rosneft and Lukoil, and the President of the United States called off the summit meeting with Putin in Budapest, which he had himself proposed. So this is what happened. Now, it appears that at some point over the last few weeks, someone in the United States, perhaps the president himself, perhaps officials around the president, persuaded the president that this course was leading nowhere, that the Russians were not going to bend, that the assumption that the military situation in Donbass was stable and perhaps even tilting in Ukraine's favour was completely wrong, that it was becoming clear that the Russians were on the brink of a breakthrough, and someone apparently persuaded Trump to go back to what had been agreed between himself and Putin in Alaska. And again, it's not entirely clear how this came about. There was a trip that Dmitriev made to Washington about 2 weeks ago, and there's a general assumption that over the course of that trip, it was over the course of that trip that Dmitriev and Witkoff got together and started working on this plan, or rather on this document that now is going to flesh out the plan. I don't think so, actually. My understanding is that Dmitriev found that the Americans over the course of that trip were unresponsive and reported this to Putin and to the Russian Security Council. I understand that there has been an adjustment since, and I suspect that Dmitriev and Witkoff have probably resumed contact since that visit that Dmitriev made, which may have been unsuccessful. Anyway, this is a detail that is of no real consequence. But anyway, Dmitriev and Witkoff have therefore got together with teams, various teams, Vance, Rubio, some are saying Jared Kushner as well, and they're all working together now, trying to get this paper sorted. Now, this is an important moment, because working on an actual paper, a physical document, setting out in writing what the two governments essentially agreed with each other in Anchorage, crystallizes that agreement. As I understand it, the discussions in Anchorage, and before that, the discussions between Witkoff and Putin in Moscow were verbal. Obviously, the Russians have a stenographic record of those discussions. I've discussed that already. The Americans will have such a stenographic record as well, the kind of record that note keepers make, the interpreters make. And if we're talking about Witkoff's meetings with Putin in the Kremlin, I'm pretty sure that the Russians have an actual voice recording of that discussion as well, just saying. But that is not the same as an actual worked through document which the two sides have got together and are working upon. When we reach that point, when the two sides, two governments, start working on a document of this kind, then obviously we are going beyond a verbal discussion, even a verbal discussion where a consensus has been reached. We are actually now at that stage when things are being officially and formally reduced to writing, and the agreement, the tentative agreement, the verbal agreement, the informal agreement, if you prefer, the understanding, to use the word that Putin used, the, when that agreement is actually crystallizing and is beginning to gain formality and substance. So this is an important event. From this moment onwards, there is something in writing that the Americans and the Russians have been working upon with each other, which sets out their basic consensus, and which they can then distribute to the Europeans, to the Ukrainians, to everyone else. And anybody who has been involved in negotiations, and I, by the way, have been involved in very many in my previous life, anybody who has been involved in negotiations knows that when this happens, that is a very important moment. Each side at that point is making a commitment, which, whilst it might not necessarily lead to a final agreement in the process, certainly does take one much closer to that point. Now, having said all of that and explained all of this, there's many, many questions. And this is where I'm now going to discuss what the agreement itself, or what this document, which of course I have not seen, and nor has anybody else, what it contains. Well, the first thing to say is that it is clearly based on Istanbul Plus. And Lavrov, in the interview with Corriere della Sera, and in the previous interviews that he's given to the Russian media and his various press conferences, has essentially already led us to expect that. So it is clearly based on Istanbul Plus. There are contradictions and disagreements about what exactly it says, but there are certain points where we can say with some confidence that the two sides have indeed reached a consensus. The first is about Ukraine's neutral status. Lavrov has again reaffirmed this today. He has spoken about this over the course of a press conference he gave today, over the course of a meeting in Moscow with the foreign minister of Laos. He said that obviously a lasting settlement of the Ukraine conflict is only possible through eliminating its root causes. It is necessary to reliably guarantee Russia's security, neutralize the threats emanating from the aggressive expansion of NATO, and stop attempts to draw Ukraine into this militaristic alliance. It is no less important to ensure that the rights of Russian and Russian-speaking people in the territories controlled by the Kiev regime are respected. Now, I'll come to all of that shortly. So, again, we don't exactly know what this document says, but it appears that there will not be membership of NATO for Ukraine. There is an article, I believe, in the Wall Street Journal, which says that NATO membership has been put on pause, implying that it might be revived later. I suspect that originates with Keith Kellogg, who there is some reason to think is behind the leaks of this information to the media. I cannot imagine that the Russians have agreed to that. And from what I can tell, from everything that I am hearing and reading about this document, it appears that NATO membership for Ukraine is excluded. There are to be security guarantees for Ukraine, but also, interestingly, for Russia, and these are to be provided by the United States and various other countries. It is unclear which countries. The security guarantees for Ukraine, I have no doubt, are going to be along the lines of what was set out in the Istanbul Agreement of April 2022. They will fall far below the threshold of what of the kind of security guarantees NATO membership would have provided. That is one thing. There will be a drastic reduction in the size of Ukraine's armed forces. Now, about this, there are different versions as to what exactly has been agreed. Axios, apparently, is saying that the size of Ukraine's army will be halved. The Economist, I believe it's The Economist, much more plausibly, is saying that Ukraine's military will be reduced by 2.5 times. In other words, the Ukrainian military will become a very much smaller force than the one which exists today. My guess is, on the assumption that the active force of the Ukrainian army on the front lines is 250,000 at the present time. I actually believe it is less than that, significantly less than that, but the nominal figure might be somewhere in the region of 250,000. The Ukrainian army will be cut back to a force of about 50,000. The United States will curtail weapons deliveries to Ukraine. I'm not quite sure what the word curtail means, but I presume it will mean that the Ukrainians will not be provided with further weapons by the United States. Ukraine will give up all of its long-range weapons, its drones, its missiles, weapons that can reach Russian territory. Some say weapons that can reach as far as Moscow and St. Petersburg. Again, as I said, there are different accounts, and that might reflect different views set out in this draft, in this document, in this paper, which is still clearly being worked upon. Now, this, of course, conforms completely to the Russian position for the effective demilitarization of Ukraine and for the drastic reduction in the size of Ukraine's armed forces. Something which up to now, well, since April 2022, the Ukrainians have categorically refused to discuss and which they are strongly resisting. There are to be no foreign forces in Ukraine. So from this, after this agreement, after peace is achieved, there will be no Western troops stationed anywhere on the territory of Ukraine. The plan that Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron have devoted so much time to, of a coalition of the willing and peacekeeping forces and all of that kind of thing, that has now been buried. The Americans not only are not going to provide a backstop for such a force, something that Macron and Starmer and co. have been agitating for constantly ever since this disastrous idea was first proposed in February. Not only are the Americans not going to provide a backstop, but it seems that they have agreed that there will never be a deployment in Ukraine of such a force at all, ever. Now, there are some claims that peacekeepers might be introduced from other countries, from Turkey, those sort of places. To be frank, I think that is extremely unlikely. Then there are other provisions which apparently have been agreed and which I think will be completely unacceptable to the Zelensky government and to the political forces in Ukraine. One is for Russian apparently to be made a state language in Ukraine, presumably being given equal status to Ukrainian. I say that the last part is my interpretation, but I cannot see how a language can be made a state language without being given equal status. We would be looking at a situation similar to that in Canada, where French and English, as I understand it, are both state languages and must therefore be used in all documents. Well, if that is so, then the entire Maidan project has failed, given the extent to which Russian is actually the most commonly spoken language in Ukraine. And here, by the way, I should mention something that I've already touched on in an article I've written for the Durand's Substack site. I have heard that over the last 2 years, there has been a major swing back in using Russian in Ukraine, that it has again become the most widely spoken language amongst young people, including school children, that it is again the most widely spoken language in the workplace, and that it is now increasingly the language that the army uses. Anyway, given how dominant Russian has historically been in this territory and how it is reasserting itself, despite efforts made by the current Ukrainian government to suppress it, giving Russian equal status will, in effect, Russify Ukraine, and many Ukrainians, many members of the Maidan movement, will see that as, in effect, undermining the entire drive towards Ukrainian independence. It would almost certainly lead in time to a much closer relationship between Ukraine and Russia, if it were ever to happen and if it were ever to be enforced. And the Russian Orthodox Church is apparently to be re-established and, in effect, again be given back its official status. And given that it was by far the most widely supported church amongst Orthodox believers in Ukraine, who are the majority of believers in Ukraine, again, I cannot see how reinstating the Russian Orthodox Church now, maybe I should say the Orthodox Church, because the Orthodox Church in Ukraine, as previously constituted, only had a vestigial connection to Russia. But of course, the events of the last 4 years, and in particular, the government's attempt at its suppression, will have reinforced those links, which had previously been becoming weaker. Just saying. But anyway, I cannot see how restoring the status of the Orthodox Church at this time and in this way is also not again going to lead to a closer relationship with Russia. So these are major steps. Lavrov spoke about ensuring the rights of Russian and Russian-speaking people in the territories. Well, we see that this is a major step that is being taken. By the way, my understanding is that giving Russian status as a state language goes beyond what was actually contained in the original Istanbul Agreement of April 2022. And to say it simply, it marks a radical change in the political and cultural position of Russian in Ukraine. I believe it goes beyond the rights that Russian had at the time of Ukraine's independence and which were originally enshrined in Ukraine's constitution. So if I'm reading this correctly, and I believe I am, by the way, then, as I said, this marks a radical change and one whose importance cannot be overstated. Now, on the territorial issues, there are some uncertainties. There is apparently agreement that Ukraine is going to completely withdraw from Donbass. There are apparently some proposals that the territory that is currently under Ukrainian control, but which would then pass to Russia, would be demilitarized. In other words, that the Russians would not be able to state to have troops there. And there are also suggestions that the Russians would rent this territory from Ukraine and pay some kind of rent to Ukraine for this territory, something which I don't for one moment believe. There are apparently alternative provisions in this draft, and I'm sure that these are the ones that ultimately will prevail, that the entire territory of Donbass will indeed be accepted as Russian, and most controversially, that the United States will recognize both Crimea and Donbass, Lugansk and Donetsk, as part of Russia. Ukraine will not be asked to do the same, but the United States will. Now, if that is the case, then obviously the idea of the Russians renting this territory from Ukraine, an absurd idea, will have to be dropped. It might have been an early proposal, but as I said, I'm sure it's one of those proposals that often comes up in negotiations and which, when the parties talk about things with each other, falls by the wayside. The Russians might agree for a time not to station troops in western Donbass, the territories that are currently under Ukrainian control. But bear in mind that if this territory is Russian, then eventually the Russians will want to be able to station their army on Russian territory. Now, about Kherson and Zaporozhye region, there continues to be some idea, apparently, of a freeze on the existing conflict lines, though these have moved significantly. Anyway, that apparently is still there and perhaps will remain there at least for the time being. However, it's worth pointing out again that Lavrov has already made it clear that for the Russians this is a transitional position, and that the Americans agreed, apparently in Alaska, that eventually Zaporozhye and Kherson regions would pass to Russia. His exact words, set out in the interview he gave to Corriere della Sera, are as follows. Washington op also openly admitted that it will not be able to ignore the territorial issue following the referendums in Russia's five historical regions, whose residents unambiguously chose self-determination apart from the Kiev regime and chose reunification with Russia. So it's clear to me that whatever is being discussed about Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, from a Russian point of view, will be seen as transitional. Eventually, the Russians expect all of these territories to pass to themselves. Now, bear in mind that if this whole agreement, in its existing form, were to come into effect, the political geography of Ukraine will have been completely changed. So the Russians would be in control of Donbass, the line of the fortified cities, the dam which has held back the Russians up to now, the Russian flood up to now, as I somewhat evocatively said in my program yesterday, that dam will have gone. Ukraine's army will have been severely reduced in size, and Russian will be a state language in Ukraine. I cannot imagine, on the assumption that any of these things will happen, that a Ukrainian government formed in these conditions would be able to resist the transfer of Zaporozhye and Kherson regions to the Russians, given the Russian insistence that these territories are indeed Russian, and the likely view opinions of many of the people there. So anyway, much that remains unclear, but that, it seems to me, is the best picture that we have of this document. Now, as I said, clearly this is a work in progress, but to reiterate again, it is Istanbul Plus. In all essentials, it is Istanbul Plus, and its provisions about the state language, and by the way, as far as I know, about the status of the Orthodox Church, but certainly about the state language, appear to go beyond what Putin proposed in his speech to the foreign ministry on the 14th of June 2024. At least that's my understanding. And one could see that in some respects the terms are becoming harsher, and certainly they are significantly harsher than the terms that Ukraine almost agreed in Istanbul in April 2022. So there's a number of very important questions. The first and the obvious one is, why now? Why, after Trump said to Zelensky when they last met in Washington about 4 weeks ago that he once more was going back to the Kellogg plan, to the ceasefire and the freeze of the conflict on the existing ceasefire lines. Why is Donald Trump, why is the administration, the reports are saying that Donald Trump is in agreement with the outline proposals set out in the document, in this document. Why is he now reverting, going all the way back to what he agreed with Putin in Alaska? Well, there is one overwhelmingly simple answer because of the military situation. It's becoming increasingly clear that the story, the fairy tale that Ukraine, Zelensky and Kellogg and others were plugging over the last few months, that Ukraine was holding its own on the battlefronts, that that was a complete fairy tale. Trump now understands that if the war continues, Ukraine is going to go down. There will be a defeat in Donbass. Donbass is soon going to pass entirely under Russian control. And at that point, whatever remaining leverage over the Russians still exists will have gone. And the Russians could start demanding much more, Dnipropetrovsk region and Kharkiv region and other things, and might not be in a mood to settle diplomatically at all. So that is one reason, and I think it is the compelling and most important reason, by the way. On this topic, I should say that I've received a very important email from a source, somebody who has had contacts with agencies that could be said to be part of the American government. I'm choosing my words very carefully. Anyway, this person has told me that certainly the intelligence community of the United States and the intelligence communities of various Western governments are fully aware of the true level of Ukrainian casualties, and that they are under no illusions about the fantastic figures that Zelensky and his officials have been plugging, and that they also know or have ideas about the actual realities of the state of the Ukrainian armed forces. And this dovetails with a report that has just been published by Russia's Foreign Intelligence Agency, the SVR. The SVR has published a report in which it says that intelligence agencies, Western intelligence agencies, over the last few weeks have reported to Western governments that Ukraine is fast losing the war, that the anti-Russian project in Ukraine has been a complete failure, and that policy needs to be adjusted to reflect this. The SVR is also saying that Western governments, at least European governments, are rejecting these findings and are in complete denial about the situation and remain committed to the anti-Russian course that they have been following in Ukraine up to now. So, anyway, Trump, perhaps, is finally being told the truth, or is finally seeing the truth. I accept this information that the intelligence services in the United States have been informed, fully informed about the real situation. It's probably the case, though, and I'm guessing here, that Trump himself has not been told the truth about it by certain top officials within the United States. I'm not going to devote more time to this discussion. But anyway, it's the military, the change in the military situation and information about it That probably is far and away the biggest reason for the Trump administration's return, if you like, to Anchorage. But I suspect that there are other reasons as well. Firstly, the Trump administration is again coming up against the problem of its lack of leverage over Moscow. It has now become completely clear that China is not going to reduce its purchases of Russian oil or compromise in any way on its relations with Russia. In fact, the Chinese Prime Minister Li Qian has recently been in Moscow to attend a meeting of prime ministers of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And over the course of this meeting, the day before yesterday, Li Qian also had a meeting with none other than Vladimir Putin. And the Kremlin has published transcripts of this meeting, and the meeting the impression was that the meeting was exceptionally friendly. Now, I've discussed the reasons for China's stance many times. I'm not going to discuss it further here in this program. The key point, however, is that the United States now knows that China is not going to change its policy, and the United States has seen over the last few weeks that in any economic war between itself and China, China holds all the high cards. China is in a position to block exports of rare earths to the United States, which would have a significant impact on America's industrial economy, including its critically important AI sector and its defense industries. And interestingly, over the last day or so, the Dutch government appears to have finally caved over the Nexpedia affair. Nexpedia, Dutch headquartered company owned in China with much of its production in China, providing medium and low-level chips heavily used to the car by the car industry. The Dutch government, prompted by the United States, attempted to take control of Nexpedia, ousting its Chinese-appointed CEO. That led to China, or Nexpedia in China, taking retaliatory steps, which was blocking off supplies of vitally necessary chips to the European and American car industries. After much hand-wringing and anxiety, the Dutch government has caved and has returned, at least that's the last report I have seen, has returned Nexpedia back to the control of its Chinese owners. So, using sanctions to pressure China, to pressure Russia, is impossible. And that deprives the United States, in effect, of all economic leverage over China. Now, the United States has also attempted to impose leverage over India as well. There are lots of contradictory claims about what is actually happening in the oil market between on the Indian oil market. But the Russian ambassador to India, in advance of Vladimir Putin's trip to India, says that overall, the oil relationship between India and Russia has not been severely affected. He's made a statement that Russia continues to be India's main source for oil. Well, that might be overstating things, but anyway, that is what the Indian ambassador, sorry, the Russian ambassador to India says. He's saying that India continues to import 30% of its oil from Russia. He does accept that there's probably been some recalibration and reorganization of Indian oil exports, but he says that he doesn't expect that to change. Well, as I said, that's what he says. It may be right or it may be wrong. The Russian oil minister, Novak, has said that Russian oil production has been unaffected by the sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft. Anyway, one way or the other, the United States might be coming round to recognising that its leverage over Russia simply is not there. But what is happening, and again, I can't help but think that this must be having some effect on US policy, is that these sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft have indeed caused disruptions in global energy markets. There are reports that the price of diesel oil in the United States, for example, is rising. There have been major election defeats by the Republicans in the United States over the last few weeks, about the last 10 days. And, well, one can imagine that given all of that, the president and his officials are now rethinking their policies. So one can come up with explanations why the US has shifted ground. But then, of course, we come to the next question. Is there any prospect at all, that the Ukrainians are going to accept this proposal and that the Europeans are going to accept these proposals once this document has been ironed out? And the answer, straightforwardly, is no. There is no chance that they will accept them. Yesterday, the Financial Times said that Zelensky had already rejected these proposals. Now, there was a lot of reports yesterday about a meeting that was supposed to happen between Witkoff and Zelensky in Istanbul. As I understand it, what happened was that Zelensky cut short his pointless European road trip. He dashed back to Kiev. Maybe he was expecting or intending to meet the US military delegation that's arriving in Kiev, led by one of the deputy US War Secretaries, Dan Driscoll. Anyway, he came back to Kiev, I'm guessing, for that purpose. He then learnt that Witkoff was in Istanbul, was refusing to meet Yermak, Zelensky's chief of staff, was demanding to see Zelensky himself. Zelensky then dashed off to Turkey. He had a meeting with Erdogan. He made it absolutely clear, however, that he was not going to accept anything remotely like the proposal that Witkoff is working on with Dmitriev and the Russians. When Witkoff heard that, and when Witkoff learnt that Zelensky was bringing his own proposal, which is, again, the Kellogg plan, freeze of the conflict, introduction of European peacekeepers in Western Ukraine, all of those things, Witkoff decided that a meeting with Zelensky was pointless because the proposal Zelensky was bringing with him would be completely unacceptable to the Russians. Humiliatingly for Zelensky, he then cancelled the meeting, causing Zelensky to return to Kiev with his tail between his legs. Just saying. So Zelensky is not going to accept this proposal, nor, of course, are the Europeans. There is another element to this proposal, and we know about this from Dmitriev. I touched on it yesterday, that apparently somewhere in this paper, there is also a provision about talks or discussions to reconsider the security architecture in Europe. And beyond that, the proposal as it stands is obviously and completely unacceptable to the Europeans. It would be, in effect, a Russian victory. The Europeans have already made clear that they will not accept this proposal. Reuters has published a report saying that the Europeans are already pushing back against the proposal, and the French government is now openly denouncing the proposal. Jean-Noël Barrot, France's foreign minister, says peace cannot mean capitulation. We do not want the capitulation of Ukraine. And so he's already, in effect, calling this capitulation by Ukraine. We're told that several other European leaders have hit out at the plans, which were negotiated in secret over the last few weeks. Kaya Kallas, obviously, says that the proposals would now be the focus of talks in Brussels instead of how to hit Russia's economy and exports. And anyway, there is a complete rejection by all the usual people in Europe of this proposal. For the Europeans, for Ursula von der Leyen, for Friedrich Merz, for Kaya Kallas, for Macron, for Starmer, for all of them, this proposal would be a catastrophic, humiliating defeat. They are definitely, categorically going to oppose it. They have always made it clear that the only agreement, only negotiated settlement they will accept is one which is on their and Ukraine's terms, one which allows Ukraine to join both NATO and the EU, one which recognises Ukrainian sovereignty over all its pre-2014 territory, including Donbass and Crimea as well, one which provides for Russia to pay a reparation loan to reparations to Ukraine, thereby reimbursing the Europeans for the reparation loan that they've been currently talking about. I've discussed all this at massive lengths. There's any number of reasons why the Europeans will reject this plan. And of course, that is exactly what they are currently doing. So Zelensky is going to reject it. The Europeans are going to reject it too. So are Zelensky's opponents in Kiev. And this is a point that people need to understand. There has been a lot of discussion about the current corruption investigations in Ukraine. There's been various suggestions as to what those are all about. One view is that Nabu and Sapol have been launched against Zelensky by the United States in order to remove him from office so that a more compliant leader can take his place who will agree to these proposals with the Russians. I cannot imagine that that is the case, for the simple reason that there is no such person in Kiev. No political leader in Kiev, not Poroshenko, not Klitschko, not Tymoshenko, would agree to these proposals. Zeluzhny in London is not going to agree to these proposals either. None of them would agree to these proposals. They would recognise in these proposals the end of Ukraine and of the Maidan project. It is highly likely that if proposals like this were ever put into effect, the Ukrainian government, as it currently exists, would lose authority across the entire regions. It would probably collapse. Almost certainly, there would be a much more pro-Moscow compliant government set up in Kiev. Already in Moscow, Nikolai Azarov, the exiled former Ukrainian prime minister, is saying that the way to implement these proposals is through regime change in Kiev. That is the only guarantee whereby these proposals can be made effective. And of course, that ensures, that guarantees that all of these people in Ukraine, Klitschko, Poroshenko, Tymoshenko, Zeluzhny, are going to oppose these proposals, because regime change of that kind is exactly what they don't want, because it will leave them out in the cold. There is an alternative view, which is that these investigations have been launched by the European Union in order to put pressure on Zelensky to force him to agree to mobilize young Ukrainians at the age of 18. Events in Ukraine, which is an outstanding blog, by the way, discussing the internal situation in Ukraine, has been the major proponent of this theory. And it is absolutely correct that the people in Nauru and Sarpok who are promoting these anti-corruption investigations and what might be called the pro-European middle-class liberal intelligentsia in Kiev, who are also most strongly supporting these investigations, are the most pro-war constituency in Ukraine, bar none, and that they are linked to the Europeans, and that since the cut-off of funding to Nauru and Sarpol that took place after the closure of USAID, it is the European Union that has been paying the bills for Nauru and Sarpol, and which has been running this operation. However, I have received authoritative information on this point from a source with access to information in Hungary. And this confirms, and I have no doubt at all about the validity of this information, that the truth is the complete opposite. It seems that, in fact, EU ambassadors have given a warning to Nauru and Sarpol, telling them to back off the investigations and warning them that the EU does not want to see Zelensky undermined or the political situation in Kiev upset or destabilized. And apparently the political class in Kiev, including the investigators in Nauru and Sarpol, have been warned that Zelensky's trips to Athens and Paris confirm that the European Union continues to support him. So the European Union, European governments, are coming to Zelensky's aid. And once again, at a moment when his position in Kiev has looked unstable, they have acted to shore him up. Now, those who have been following my programs closely will find that completely unsurprising. Zelensky might be utterly corrupt. The entire system that props him up in Kiev might be utterly corrupt also. But from the European Union's point of view, his position as president of Ukraine is too important, both presentationally and in terms of ensuring stability in Ukraine, to allow it to be seriously threatened. So, apparently, this warning from the European Union has caused a shock amongst people in Kiev, the people in Kiev. But I've no doubt that it will be heeded, and we're probably going to see the heat come off Zelensky from the corruption investigators over the next couple of days. A clear sign that this is the case is the reemergence of one of the individuals who seem to be involved in the corruption allegations, and that is the former Ukrainian Defense Minister, Rustem Umerov. There are reports that he had fled the country. There are reports that he had gone to Turkey and then to the UAE. There were reports that he had fled to the United States and even claimed political asylum there. Well, when Zelensky came to Turkey, there was Umerov again. And apparently Zelensky and Umerov shook hands. It's not clear whether Umerov does now intend to return to Ukraine. Perhaps not. But the fact is, he went out of his way to be seen alongside Zelensky again. And Zelensky, for his part, appeared to be completely unembarrassed by the fact. So, there it is. I don't believe that either the United States or the European Union was behind this corruption investigation in Kiev. Apparently, it began last year in 2024. That was when the first steps taken to launch this investigation were made. I believe that the people who were behind this investigation were Zelensky's opponents in Kiev, his political opponents in Kiev, people like Poroshenko and Klitschko and Tymoshenko and the rest. And again, that is unsurprising. I'm not going to waste time, as I said, analysing this investigation, but it has always looked to me to be a power struggle. And it's a power struggle which, with the backing of the European Union, Zelensky at the moment looks likely to win. So that is what I think is taking place in Ukraine. And I'm going to say something further here. Precisely because the Americans and the Russians are now working on this proposal, this paper that I've spent so much of today's program discussing, I firmly expect the opposition to Zelensky in Kiev over the next couple of days to start to melt away. It is absolutely the case that everybody in Kiev now understands that the war is lost. Everybody in Kiev understands that things are falling apart. But they do not want the war to end on these American terms. That would be a greater disaster for them than a situation where Ukraine is defeated militarily. Far better the latter outcome than one in which they are pushed aside and marginalised. What they want to see is the war to continue, the money flow into Kiev to continue, and if keeping Zelensky in place is the price they have to pay for that, they will pay it. So that is what I think is going to happen. We are going to see a hardening in Kiev, a stabilization, a temporary stabilization in Kiev, out of the need to push back against this Witkoff Dmitriev plan. And we are going to see a rally behind Zelensky by the European Union. All of which, of course, means that the plan is going to be stillborn. The only big question thereafter is what then is the United States going to do? Well, you could say that this is the moment when Donald Trump finally walks away. He's got a plan. He's got it all sorted out. Witkoff has laid it out in writing with Dmitriev. This is the moment when the plan is rejected. It's absolutely clear that the Europeans and the Ukrainians are never going to agree to peace, that they're the main roadblock to achieving peace. And at that point, you could argue that this is the moment of truth for Trump. He can finally walk away. I would love to think that. But, well, we've seen over the last year that when we reach this very same point, what invariably happens is that Trump has cold feet. He then starts listening to the neocons and the hardliners again, and his default position always falls back towards supporting Ukraine. So I have to say, based on experience, that is what I expect is going to happen. The only thing that makes me retain some doubt is the fact that Kellogg himself is now quitting the scene. That may mean that this time Trump has decided once and for all that he's going to go with the Witkoff approach. But frankly, thinking that would be hope over experience. And here I am going to stick with experience. In some respects, it really doesn't matter. Given that the Ukrainians are going to reject the plan, given that the Europeans are going to reject the plan, that only leaves the way forward for a military solution, which is what Professor Mearsheimer, for example, has been saying would be the outcome all along. What Trump himself decides from this point, whether he distances himself further from the war or whether he once again re-engages with it, really is irrelevant to any question except possibly the question of the war's duration. But one way or the other, I still remain of the view that all of this is in the end going to lead nowhere, and we're going to be back to a military solution. I'm going to finish this discussion by again referring, however, to that important article written some months ago by Kautilya the Contemplator on his Substack blog. He said that the invariable story of negotiations that the United States engages in when it finds itself in these kind of wars is negotiations where the United States appears initially to take a hard line and rejects the proposals being made by the other side, only ultimately to capitulate completely to them. And this was the story in Korea and Vietnam and in Afghanistan. And, well, we could see that precisely this is happening again. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish my long discussion of the Witkoff-Dmitriev plan. In a sense, it's interesting. It might have some bearing in the future. Perhaps it will pave the way for some kind of improvement in the future for US-Russian relations. But given the hostility to this plan by the Ukrainians and the Europeans, it's going to fail. There's already articles in the Washington Post saying as much. There's obviously pushback against it from Reuters. It is going to fail. The war will go on towards its inevitable conclusion, which now everybody can see is a Russian victory. Now, I have not left myself time to discuss the military situation, which is a problem because there's been dramatic news. Firstly, that massive missile and drone strike that took place was perhaps the most extraordinary and the most powerful that the Russians have conducted until now. They were able to launch 7 KH-101 missiles to destroy one factory in one town of Tornopil. And the video footage of this attack is astonishing. I cannot see any evidence at any point of Ukrainian air defenses operating, despite the usual Ukrainian claims that they shot down most of the Russian drones and some of the Russian missiles. It looks to me as if this entire operation was carried out without any real air defense at all. And if we are talking about the military situation on the battlefronts, there's been further bigger Russian advances in Zaporozhye region. The Russians seem to have captured significant areas in Mirnograd, and there is now fighting underway in Siversk. And to say it simply, I believe that Siversk is about to fall. Anyway, all of this I am going to discuss in much more detail in my program tomorrow. This is where I finish. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and also our Substack. Our Substack site. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.